hey, friends, you're going to listen to a great podcast in a couple seconds, and that's going to be really, really fun. But you want to know what's better? When you're listening to a great podcast that has been verified and vetted by a great podcast award like this podcast is up for right now. Oh, man, I'm so excited to wait for that one day when this podcast will be recognized with a podcast award.
Justin, hold on. Breaking news. We've already been nominated for a podcast award if you go to podcastawards.com. And before you do that, actually, head on over because some concerned citizens have put together a website, hat.t2t2.eu. That's hat, like the thing you put on your head, .t2t2, which are words that don't mean anything to you, .eu. And if you go, he put together a little bookmarklet where all of, most likely all of your favorite podcasts will show up. And then you could just go through very, very quickly and easily on podcastawards.com. You could vote every single day. Just remember, once you vote, you will get an email. Unless you click on that email and verify it, you have to click on the link of the email. If it's not a verified vote, it doesn't count. But you can vote every single day for the next couple of weeks.
This is something super, super fun. And it gives us the best chance of winning if we vote the slate. Support great independent shows. That's what this is all about. Thank you guys so much for doing that. And hopefully we will bring home the podcast award based on your guys' passion. Hey, vote every day. 1 week left.
Vote me every day.
Hat.t2t2.eu.
Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hey, everybody, it's me.
Brian Brushwood.
The vultures are ready to hear some weird things. Ready.
Gentlemen, speaking of some weird things, a topic that's been sitting in my little inbox for a while that I wanted to talk about is there's a very interesting thing that we talk about when it comes to history. And history and archaeology, it's one of those things where we're really good at finding things where we know to look for things. It's kind of a duh, I know.
Yeah. Well, no. Or at least suspect. Like, it helps to... Like, what was it? Among first principles is if you're going to start digging is because you have an idea of what might be down there, right?
True, for sure. And the thing that we kind of sort of when we start looking, you start talking about what happened centuries ago, thousands of years ago, we tend to sort of forget how much the Earth has changed. You know, there was a little ice age that ended in, the 19th century, right? And then so you had colder periods there. Then you had a warm period in the medieval warm period, and then you had, it was cool for a while, you had a Roman warming area, there was a Roman warming area too, it was very popular in all the homes.
It was called the bath.
And we're finding out more about this sort of climactic change, and then we have the biggie around, 7,000 to 8,000, 9,000 years ago as we started to come out of our interglacial period where it got warmer, right? So when you go back 10,000 years ago, you had the glaciers were much larger than they are today. And actually, they did expand during the Little Ice Age, too, which is kind of interesting little note where you'll like the glaciers, a lot of them did some expansion. But anyhow, you go back 10,000 years ago, we had an ice age, right? And as we start looking for the roots of human civilization, we find a lot of stuff in the Middle East, but then it starts to get hazy around there because there probably was dramatic climatic change, floodings, etc. But as we start to dig deeper, we're finding out some interesting stuff. We've talked about Göbekli Tepe, which I've never pronounced the name of that right, which is the archaeological site in Turkey, Göbekli Tepe. Someday somebody will correct me on this and tell me how to say it like somebody who's not an idiot. But this is an archaeological site that's got 20-ton structures, 20-ton carved stones, that was built in several phases going back 10,000 years and possibly more, and in actually possibly predating agriculture, right?
Right.
So it's J-G, O with the dots on top, B-E-K-L-I-T-E-P-E, and you can find out some interesting things about this as we start to explore more. So one of these really cool archaeological mysteries is where we know very, very little about the people who made it. And it's starting to expand your idea that, man, those ancient people 10,000 years ago, they were building some really cool stuff that was, you know, we didn't think they could do till another 5,000 years later. Now we have another interesting discovery.
Which
is potentially even more revealing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, let's go. Let's check it out.
We got Weird Things 1 ready for takeoff. And so, I need a go, no go. Where are we also coordinates? Where are we going?
We think that agriculture started about 12,000 years ago. Okay.
You said 12,000?
12,000.
Okay.
That was sort of the idea of the roots of agriculture. And somebody pointed out the roots of agriculture. It'd kill me. if you knew how much I hated puns. Ugh. So anyhow, 12,000 years ago is where we say that we think that it started. And somebody said, how could you feed your workers to build that without agriculture? You just forage really, really wildly, and maybe you just eat a lot of meat. But now
I would also imagine that there's some kind of agriculture, I guess, is defined as you designate land, you chop, you know, you carve it all up, you plant seeds, you grow with what you want. But I would imagine that in between, you had to get really efficient at knowing. It's like, yeah, we know there's always cherry trees over here. We know there's always this tree over here.
And sometimes they sort of describe it as sort of like, kind of like horticulture is sort of the smaller kind of scale of that. And then you sort of ease into agriculture. First, you start hunting, gathering, and you're like, oh, if I plant these, I don't have to walk very far. And I can just stare. Sometimes they would have plots that you'd travel away from and come back to. But anyhow, there's been a very interesting evolution of that. And agriculture is one of the things that we thought you needed that to start cities. And now we're finding evidence of cities that existed prior to agriculture, we think. Well, there are some researchers that have found evidence of a location in the Mideast. They found evidence of weeds that implies that there was some human cultivation for agriculture that was in they call it the Ohalatu people, who were fisher hunter gatherers established. They had a stationary human camp. The site they've locationally found was very well preserved, having charred and covered by lake sediment and sealed in low oxygen conditions, perfect for preserving plant materials. The researchers examined, they found the weed species for the morphological signs of domestic type cereals and harvesting tools. So they found some evidence that this stuff was actually being cultivated, that they had actually been planting there along with other forms of eating or food production. The date for this, 23,000 years ago.
So
So that's longer than 12.
Yes, it is. But I guess, that's...
It was a human camp on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. So it's from a study in the Plus One by Professor Ehud Weiss of Bar-Ilan University in collaboration with Professor Marcelo Sternberg of the Department of Molecular Biology and Ecology Plants at TAU's Faculty of Life Center, and at Harvard.
Do you think this is a case where, like,
just
this
really excited that Galilee is finally going to be known for something?
finally. So we know that agriculture was developed independently at multiple times at around the same time. I guess it would make sense that there would be precursor civilizations that would have it, and whether they survived, and the idea of went around, because on top of all of this, there's not only the question of, like, you know, who was the first, but also, you know, what evidence do we have to support it, you know? Because it's like the idea that – sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm listening.
Oh, well, I'm just saying, like, you picture the same idea sprouts up multiple places around the same time, some of them because other people directly have heard of predecessor or neighbors doing similar things, but then others of them would be like little bubbles popping, and then, like, you know, a civilization develops an idea, a meme grows, and then that civilization dies and craters and vanishes and is sort of lost forever, and you have to wait for it to independently happen again. It would be really, really amazing if we ever had archaeological techniques advanced enough for us to know whether or not this instance of agriculture, assuming that's what it is, directly had descendants. Like, you know, from here we could tell it what the idea went to this place, to that place, to that place.
One of the things that we look for now is, because of DNA, is we look for to see if we can find any of the grains, if they're related, if they're transferred from one point to another. So there's some stuff we're doing microbial. So there are some ways in which we can do that. But here's what I want you to think about. We this may have pushed back agriculture 10,000 years, and understand what that means from, you know, 23,000 to 12,000 years ago. If we go back 10,000 years from the present, we're talking 8,000 BC.
Yeah.
And 8,000 BC is a part when we talk about Doggerland. This is one of our favorite topics here. Doggerland is that region between the United Kingdom, the British Isles, and Europe that used to be above water. It was, when the sea levels were much lower, there was fertile land that was basically, I call it Eurolantis, that was, or Doggerland is what it's known because of the Dogger Banks where this was. This is not fringe. This is real. There was much, much more land area in Europe, and people lived there. And Europe had, if you look at Europe in that context, through that lens, and you look at the Beaker civilization and these other cultures, you have a much better understanding of how they spread across, because it wasn't like there were these tiny little islands off to here and then the continent over here. It was connected. The islands had much larger surface area. Even in Roman times, they described farms on islands and places that right now for the last 1,000 years have been too small to have a farm.
Yeah. So it's one of those. So now here's the question. I assume that because so much of that land is now submerged underwater, I assume that being undersea is a harsher environment to destroy archaeological digs, because you got tides brushing everything back and forth, or does it somehow preserve it maybe?
Oceans and stuff like that are probably depends on the way in which it got covered. If you had a bunch of silt first came in and it had a muddy sort of foundation, a muddy layer on top of it, then that's one of the reasons. Like, so, you know, we talk about Mohenjo-Daro and there's like a couple of these ancient cities that were like, man, and they buried them in dirt and we don't know why. Do you know why? Because they were flooded and all the silt and mud flooded their city. And when it dried, it left a big pile of dirt.
Yeah. No, that certainly makes sense. So what are the generally accepted things we can intuit suppose based on this fairly dramatic 20,000 plus year precursor to agriculture?
I think that a project that I would love to see, and I hope that we get to at some point, is that I would like us to take a version of Google Earth and to start building the ability to go back in time and to show the change in geography and to start putting archaeological sites in there so we can start to get a better understanding. Because it's one thing when you're reading things in a text-based way and you just see this data here, this data here, this data here, but to have a little slider switch so we could roll it back and do little populations and see what that was like over time. And as we get more data about these locations, it would be an extremely powerful tool for us understanding, one, what we know now. Two is you could put in some sort of data points in there, much like a simulation game, and say, well, if you had a village of 60 people here, they're probably going to need this many calories a day. They're going to need this much water. Their replacement rate's going to be this. And you could start doing some really interesting, basically, quantitative archaeology or predictive mathematical archaeology that way. Mm-hmm. I would love for us to start putting a tool together like that, because I talk to people who know about history and they're not even aware of Doggerland. But if you have this very simple, let's scroll this, bar back and let's put all the geological data we have, you'll see how much climate's changed, how much environment's changed. And, I was just in Missoula last week, which, within 12,000 years ago, contemporaneous to when agriculture started, there was a massive flood that flooded all the way through the Pacific Northwest, which you want to talk about a humongous change in a relatively recent time. This kind of data would be cool.
And it also is, I think that there is just so much that we don't know we know it and it is publicly available, but I don't believe that in our public consciousness we understand how radically geography has kind of shifted over time. Mm-hmm. We know like Pangaea and stuff like that, but I don't feel like we, especially now as we are, I think, very, very sensitive to shorelines are changing or rising or falling. We don't necessarily apply that sensitivity through history's lens.
Yeah, we've had, if you go back, to 150,000 years ago, and how much cooler it was then, and even you look at in the last 20,000 years, as we started radically emerging out of, you know, I mean, going into interglacial period, how much these things changed in just the last 10 or 20,000 years. We kind of, you know, you go look at something, you sort of think like, yeah, it's, I guess it's sort of been like this, but older. But that's not the case. Not the case at all. How much these things have changed so radically.
Yeah, that's one of those things where, and we've talked about it before, and I think it's really unfortunate that Michael Crichton was on the wrong side of history with some of his early skepticism for global warming. But I think he did a tremendous job in his his book, was it State of Fear? Yeah, that's what it was, where he talks about how the perception that we have is that, you know, the natural state of things is pretty much the way they were now, but just different, or just, you know, more natural, whatever that means. And then, you know, he was able to talk about, you know, what we think of it, the redwoods was previous to that burned down repeatedly by you know, Indians at the time, and before that was at one point a desert and another point a sea and all that stuff. You know, having one of those, keeping in mind that on a geological level, the Earth is just a wicked fast shifting marble covered in you know, lava and moss and rain and floods and water and everything. And it's like, you know, what we think of as, you know, what something looked like forever is, you know, 20 minutes in the great scheme of things.
Gentlemen, well,
takes you much less than 20 minutes to go to patreon.com/weirdthings, Brian.
Oh yeah. Well, what could I possibly accomplish in that brief 20 minutes, sir?
Well, you can head on over there right now, become a patron, and kick us a little coin. Here's the deal. It keeps this show happening every single week, which, again, much like Doggerland, there are many, many, many people who are listening to this show right now that don't know the troubled history of our release pattern.
Oh, sure, man. I was talking to one guy who's like, oh, that weird things, that thing has always been weird and always will be. Every Sunday, like clockwork, give or take 1 or 2 hours, at 4 o'clock I tune in, and they're always there live. That weren't the case.
It's not always the case, Brian. No, no, no. We sometimes took months off. That is all gone. That has all changed. Thanks to the folks who support this show. Go ahead and check it out, patreon.com/weirdthings.
Gentlemen, one of the things that we try to do here is plan for the future. We're not just a podcast. Nay, I like to think of us as a disorganized think tank.
Visionaries.
Thought and leaders. And one of the things that I teased that we would talk about, I'm going to bring up now, terraforming the moon.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk this out. Let's talk this through. Oh. Because last time I checked, moon didn't have enough gravity to hold on to no atmosphere, much less... Think about it. We're accustomed to what, 14.5 pounds of atmosphere in our lungs at all times. That's what makes it hard to breathe at the top of a mountain and easy to breathe down at the bottom. You're telling me that with 1/6 the gravity, you're going to be able to get enough atmosphere on the moon that I could take a breath of clean, fresh lunar air? I say the nay.
I would respond to that, but I'm stifling a sneeze right now.
Okay.
Yeah. My body is so allergic to your response, Brian, your skepticism and your negativity, that it just, histamines just started tingling in me. And I'm like, I need to sneeze.
Your body's screaming, poison, poisonous thoughts.
Where do you get off tickling his histamines? That is weird of you to
do. They used to call me Histy Tickles back in college. I used to walk around with a bicycle horn. I go, hur-hee, you can't put atmosphere on the moon. Hur-hee. And then I'd
well,
off go.
Brian, I used to be like you 12 days ago. I, too, was a moon skeptic. And by the way, I heard that a joke that like that about how they you know that Stanley Kubrick faked the moon landing.
Yeah.
But Stanley Kubrick is, you know, so dedicated and serious he insisted doing it on the moon. So first answer is the moon does have a wispy somewhat of an atmosphere, Brian. It just sort of loses it very quickly because, yeah, it doesn't have a whole lot of gravity. But if we if I'm on the moon and I take my Apple Pencil and I were to drop it, what would happen, Brian?
It would go down.
By your theory, it can't hold on to it.
No. Okay, so here's my theory. My theory is
Brian doesn't believe in gravity.
Always slanderous stuff from you. No. Okay, there is gravity, but And,
at
and by
least
the way,
we can agree on that, bro.
Can I make a guess where this might be headed? I have a nutty theory, okay? Because immediately, the moment you say that, and this is one of those things where it's like just knowing that there's some theory in which it might be true has me thinking of ways that it might work. I'm going to guess that that our atmosphere, primarily nitrogen with a decent chunk of oxygen, a little bit of carbon dioxide, and trace gases, I'm going to guess that the gravity on the moon it would require a ridiculous amount of that air to get it to an air pressure that we could breathe. But even though there's weaker gravity, it seems like right now we rely on nitrogen as our inert filler gas for most of our air. And it occurred to me, what if there was a much more dense material that was our filler molecule in lunar air, and something like sulfur hexafluoride or something, it's basically like reverse helium, where it's like you suck it in and then your voice gets stupid deep like that. Like I wonder if is that part of the story?
No, Brian.
Damn. Because that would be great. Imagine if that was like lunar air instead of nitrogen, just everyone had wicked deep voices all the time. And everybody was like Barry White.
Yeah, Brian, let me make a counterpoint to your point.
Yeah, Brian, deep voices are great.
Back to you, Andrew.
It's great.
So
it's
going I think, Brian, I think there is a very – I think your idea of – was it somebody points out there's sulfur flexahor – sulfur – hexafluoride. Thank you, chat room. That might be. Listen, Brian, you may be onto a whole new branch of colonization and exobiology and the idea of how we could use that in other environments. But this is the plan.
All right,
this is the plan. Plan,
everybody. This is the plan. Get your put this laminate this.
So what we need to get on the moon is. Part of the plan is we need to build up an atmosphere. We want to build up that atmosphere and maybe build it up from oxygen, some carbon dioxide, maybe some methane, ammonia, we'll need nitrogen. And, we need all these ingredients. So to do that, here's the idea. You get a comet, like the size of Halley's Comet, right?
Sure.
You take that icy core, you steer it towards the moon. Right.
Yeah, now, are we slamming it, or are we trying to do some weird version of aerobraking, Brian, on a pencil-thin atmosphere?
I'm going to give you your answer, Brian. This is what you do. You steer it towards the moon, not Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Not Earth, no. Towards the moon. And
by the way, I can imagine no way this goes wrong since I grew up in the late 90s and watched all the movies about giant things headed towards the Earth.
Well, I mean, it's one of these things like, yeah, for it to go wrong, you would have to have like so many mistakes, like how did we end up building a cruise ship in Nevada? You'd have to like – really try to make it go wrong, but listen, anything's possible. So
by the way, guys, it's
everything will be perfectly fine with our new head of engineering, Mr. Bean.
So here's what we do: we don't have to destroy Halley's Comet. Everybody, settle down. There's the Kuiper Belt, which is filled with a bunch of icy objects. We take like a Halley's Comet size. Nucleus of the comet. Steer it towards the moon. Aim it towards the moon. Now, before it hits the moon, we detonate some explosives on it, shatter it. We hire some wildcatters, led by a bunch of guys who just got off of the oil rig and looking for a break. But then, we recruit them to go blow it up. It's going to be a great movie. And then we crash, we explode it. So it's a bunch of small giant chunks and it hits the moon. You ready?
So basically it rains, it breaks apart. I imagine all that ice maybe sublimates under the slight energy of impact with the moon.
And then we do it 99 more times.
Right? Okay. Okay. So
100 Halley comet size.
Wouldn't that add significantly to the mass of the moon?
Oh, it would, Brian. It would it would affect the mass of the moon, and it may also affect remember, the moon sort of rotates a very sort of a leisurely 28-day period. It would increase it, give it a day of about 60 hours.
Okay, so that's a lot of energy. Okay, so all right. So if I'm following you here, right now what we have is we have a locked tidal orbit. That's why we always see the same face of the moon as it goes around and around and around. And it goes around, 14 days? And so if we slammed it with 100 Halley Comets, I would imagine that we would strategically slam it both to adjust the position of the moon, maybe knock it back from the Earth a little bit. Since we're adding so much mass, we don't want two Earths that close because they'll fall into each other. So we knock it back, but also we do it with the intention of spinning up the rotation of the. So essentially, we create a twin Earth. Whoa.
So what they could do is, let me read you this. This is from Slate.com. As more comets arrive, mere days before it strikes, scientists will have to blow it apart brutally and carefully. Ice shards come gliding in all around the moon's equator, small enough that they cannot free themselves from the gravity's grip. We can't let big chunks of comets scatter off the moon to rain down as celestial buckshot on Earth. Yeah, whatever, killjoys. Within hours of the first incoming comet, the moon will have a crude atmosphere. And we call this Brian Brushwood. We call this period Brian Brushwood is wrong.
Yeah.
With 1/6 of Earth's gravity, it can hold gases for tens of thousands of years.
And by the way, this is the important distinction.
Fly you up there, Brian, and rub your nose in it.
No. This is an important distinction because one of the big killjoy things that people shout about colonizing Mars is they say, well, even if we added, threw a bunch of comets down and got a bunch of nitrogen that we stole from Titan or whatever, there's no magnetic core. Therefore, the atmosphere will be whisked away. But yes, it will happen after tens of thousands of years.
Exactly.
And if presumably we could do 500 years to put an atmosphere there, we could be bothered to do a little bit of maintenance to keep this thing going.
Precisely. And so if we're looking at the moon holding on the atmosphere for tens of thousands of years, yeah, I think we're good. For most of the moons, so as more comets arrive and pelt down, the moon spins faster. From its lazy day cycle of 28 days, it speeds up to 60 hours, close enough to an Earth-like, as they say, government work. This was a joke they put in there. For most of its life, the moon's axial tilt has been dual zero, robbing of summers and winters, but if they're angled just so, the incoming ice nuggets can tilt the poles while shortening the days, giving us seasons. And all told, we'll need 100 comets the size of Halley's, which will bring water and carbon dioxide with smidgens of methane and ammonia. We'll need nitrogen, too, and some magic from the biochemists who will pepper the moon's old gray rocks with blue-green algae that can exhale oxygen. So I think the biggest problem here, anyhow, they say that it would be kind of hot and humid and sort of cloudy like Florida.
Do they say what kind of what level of gravity there would be after you added 100 Halley comets?
I don't think we'd increase the mass substantially because Halley's Comet's not that huge. So I think that you're still going to be roughly moon-like gravity. But if we have an Earth-like atmosphere on the moon, and I'm still curious as to where they're going to get the nitrogen from this, but if we have an Earth-like atmosphere on this, we could like totally strap on wings and fly around.
Yes, and that is one of the things they explored in Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars. I want to say that in the higher reaches of Mars, like an extreme sport, you would wear a gas mask to get oxygen and then flap your wings and actually fly.
All right. So this is really, really cool. And I love this idea, but while we're on the subject, Ren Aigu in the chat realm makes a point like, okay, so since we're all into Terra maintaining the moon and Mars, right, coming up with these plans, what is to say that we cannot Terra maintain Earth? What are we looking at in terms of like, because this has always been my, and not to get into a political thing with like global warming, but I have always sort of thought that like, I don't know when in history we've ever like conserved our way out of a problem, right? Like sometimes, you know, when it comes to, factory emissions and stuff like that, sure, you can very much like reduce smog. But in general, big, big, big picture problems, usually we wind up coming up with smarter and different ways to do things. Is this a topic that, you know, is just kind of a fun back of the envelope of fantasy long read? I mean, this is a serious science. Like, is there a way to apply it here?
Well, let me put it this way. This is the simplest terms. Hey, we're going to experiment with fundamentally messing up, messing with entire planetary ecosystems, what order would you like to do them in? We could start with Mars, the moon, Titan, blah, 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 and then eventually mess around with Earth. Or we could start by messing around with Earth when we're the least experienced, the least knowledgeable, and have the least data to work with.
Okay, sure, but even then, you're saying like that it's an order of operations thing. And
I'm saying, yeah, okay. Look, of all the planets, I want to create, mess with massive environmental changes for the attention, for the idea of trying to make something work. Earth is dead last on that list. How about we take our time before we start applying crazy? We could grab a comet and fling it towards Earth. Let's Terra maintain Earth. Last place.
So part of what we get into here is it does get into a climate change discussion in the sense that we right now we're conscious of the fact that as we build a large industrial base, we have 7 billion people on the planet, and as more of them start switching, more of them start stepping up the ladder of prosperity, which means higher energy usage, which goes along with longer lifespans and quality of life, and electricity, it's kind of cool. That we face some challenges in understanding what happens as we start putting more emissions out there, CO2, methane, and carbon monoxide. That breaks down faster. But anyhow, we have a problem as we start dealing with these increased emissions and have to figure out what's going to happen with this, with these things. And right now, the thing, though, is that our climate's kind of the most rad that it's been, since, medieval warm or Roman warming period or prior to that. Like, as far as actual growth of life, the climate is actually a wonderful environment right now for growth. The planet is actually greener now than it was 40 or 50 years ago. Now, does that mean that it's on the right trajectory? Does that mean it's going the direction we want it to? Does that mean that there's not going to be trade-offs? No, that's where it gets into the really complicated questions of that. We worry about, concerned about, if it keeps getting warmer, what happens if the sea levels rise? The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration's, their sea level gauges for the United States, we've had the same level of sea level rise for the past, 100 years. So it doesn't look like we're having this radical thing that we're worried about. But there are fears that there could be these loops and feedback cycles in the system that could make things accelerate, whatever. But if you're just to purely measure it as, are there more things growing today than before, then the answer is yes. So we have this really nice optimum environment. At some point, our interglacial period will come to an end. And we're not talking hundreds. We could be talking several hundreds of years, centuries, or thousands of years. But that will happen, and it will start to get much colder. And then we have to ask ourselves, do we keep it warmer? And how warm do we want to let it get? Do we let it get as warm as it's been in the past, which it may be on a trajectory to do, partially due to our influence, but partially due to the fact that nature's got its own pattern as what it's going to do? What do we do?
I mean, this is the real shame, is it's very difficult to have any conversation like this without it sounding political one way or the other. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say universally.
Spoken like a true. Sorry.
Yeah. I'm just going to say universally, don't bet against mankind, because we're pretty much everything in our game.
Before we get angry letters, I think we all in agreement. We're all like, CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and if you start producing enough of it at a certain point, that there's effects, and I don't think we dispute that at all. I think our question gets into, and there's a paper that just came out which points out one of the things that people don't like to talk about when they're worried about, going to be the cause of that, which is this was on CNBC, and this was a paper from scientists pointing out that if we do, whatever sort of, climate radical sort of political actions that we want to take to reduce, or to decarbonize, that it's going to have, $9 to $10 trillion cost on, the economy, which is going to affect people with the lowest rungs the most. And that's the question. Are they facing greater danger from rising sea levels? Are they facing greater dangers from what we perceive to be the threats? Or is the biggest threat to them the lack of prosperity that we've benefited from?
Sure. Well, and exactly. And that's one of those where, there is no way to discuss this where it doesn't become political, because at some point you are right. You find yourself writing a prescription that robs, a family making less than $2 a day in the bottom billion of a vaccine because you need to conserve or something like that. I feel like we innovate so much. I feel like, well, give us 10 more years of collecting data, and then 10 more years after that, somebody will figure out that they could throw a barge out in the middle of the Atlantic and throw up a cloud that reflects 3% of all the sunlight off in the sky, and then it offsets, and that'll buy us another 150 years. And over that time, we could transition out of blah, 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 blah. We'll fix it. We always fix it.
And, well, Brian, you get to the fundamental problem here. You, Justin, and myself, we're technology optimists. We're aware that there's a lot of problems caused by progress. Very, very aware that technology has hiccups and has problems and it's been devastating lives of many, many people. But when we put that all on the spreadsheet and we add it all up, we're believers that technology has been, brought just unheralded amounts of prosperity that spread across, the planet. And we feel that this is demonstrable, this is observable, and that we think this will continue, not without problems, but we think that there are going to be. It's only going to continue, and historically, the biggest challenge that we've always faced, 100 years later, we're not the biggest challenges.
Yeah.
But that's our mindset.
That's the problem.
That's our point of view. And there are people saying yes until now, and then we're going to be wrong.
Well, and it's the default position and should be one of humility. Just assume that we're all idiots, that whatever we know now, we're going to learn a hell of a lot more a year, 10 years, 100 years. And we're going to think that if we take action now, and that's the part that really bristles me is the idea, we got to take action now. It's like, no, we really don't. In fact, I strongly advise against taking action now. Let's learn and then do something. Because how would we take action in 1916 with the population explosion? Well, if you look at it right now, New York is going to be swimming in 20 million people by 2016. We got to take action now. Everybody stop having babies. Everybody kill your horse. There's going to be too much horse crap in 2016. It's like, no.
But there would be people who would say that,
horse.
Hold on, BRB.
Now, but there are people who would say that, well, China did do that, and that's what staved off some huge disaster.
No,
there.
That's what created a massive problem for them. Now they're having to – now all of a sudden you have a generation of old people who have nobody to take care of them because they told everyone to not have babies, and now they're saying, well, we'll fix it again by making another law saying it's illegal for you to not take care of your grandparents. Stop. Everybody stop taking action. It's not working.
Well, Brian, I'm in agreements with you, but I have to be the other side.
Of course.
I would say that I think that there's a history of science, and not acting through science, but acting upon people's beliefs about what science tells us. And that's the difference between, let's say, science and scientism, as I use it. And you look at one of the things Crichton talked about was the history of eugenics. Eugenics was 100 years ago, eugenics was a very, very popular platform. Not in the idea, well, as I say, not overtly in the idea of racial purity, but yeah, there was a lot of forward-thinking progressives that were for that too. But Margaret Sanger, who's sort of a hero of women's right to choose, was also a eugenicist who sort of maybe was saying that maybe some people should choose more than others.
The United States history of forced sterilization is
United
one of the most,
States history, global history.
Yes. No, it's shameful. It's shameful, shameful, shameful. And those people, they were taking action. And in their hearts, it was very clear that there was a problem and a very clear solution. And all they had to do was take action. And it's just, you're going to get me upset.
Hey, let's... I don't know if this was on the docket, but I want to pop this in here. I think it's something that we've talked about before, but I feel like this podcast would be remiss if we did not address something that is very much in our wheelhouse. Elon Musk gave an interview this week wherein he said that there is a popular pet theory of his that apparently caused great problems in his house because it would bum people out when they were in his hot tub trying to have a good time. And that is his theory that we are living in a simulation of an advanced society.
I mean, it makes sense. By the numbers, certainly does solve the question of where do we come from. And here, it's like, this is that we are all individual roller coasters being run. Can you sum up the theory, Justin?
No, I mean, I know
it's the same. If you have an infinite number of, if you have the ability to make simulations and there, you know, is into the same as our reality,
so, you know,
and you could have an infinite number of simulations, then we only have a 1 in a billion chance of being in the base simulation.
Exactly.
We talk about
So basically, there's only one universe, but in that universe, you could conceive of a computer that could run a really good program called Play the Game, the universe, and you got 8 billion of those running. Then what are the odds that you're in the actual universe or in one of those computers? Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's what he made. That was exactly the argument he made.
Yeah. I don't know.
Let me just put it this way. Of the three of us on the show, one of us has a hot tub in his backyard. You permit this question to be bandied about in your hot tub, or is it too serious for people and it totally kills the mood?
Okay, man, and I guess maybe I have zero problem with this whatsoever. I think this would be wonderful. If this was the actual truth, I would feel no disappointment.
So,
I would feel not in the least bit slighted by my existence.
So to touch upon this, when I was driving back from Montana with Peter Wax, who's been on our show, I would say it was about a 16-hour drive from Montana to Denver. Fully 2/3 of that was taken up with this discussion and our thoughts on where would you go about looking for Easter eggs. If this was created by intelligent people, would they have an exit? Would they have here's how to level up and go into other simulations. Would these options be there and how would you find them?
It's pretty good. That's a pretty good justification for some treasure hunts. I think it's I doubt it. That kind of goes back to my whole assume we know nothing, right? Like the only reason we think that way is because our games have simulations, mm-hmm. because we have a forced scarcity of time on our hands, so it makes sense to create backdoors for playtesters to be able to jump around level to level. But in the future, let's say even time is unlimited, your lifetimes are unlimited, then you wouldn't even need that. But so one of the arguments, one of the first big arguments I got into philosophically in college was the idea, like, if you believe that every action or that everything has a cause, like, you let go of the ball hits the floor. Why did the ball hit the floor? Because you let go of it. Then I guess it goes to whether or not free will is an illusion. And I've spent 20 years fairly comfortable with the idea that free will is totally an illusion, and that's fine. No matter how many times you present me with a choice between eating a fresh, hot pile of dog turds and some Milk Duds, I will always choose the Milk Duds, no matter
that's
how many times
you run. That's a horrible argument for free, but it's that's...
Why is that? Because I have a preference. Why do I prefer Milk Duds over poop is because...
Brian, if I give you a knife and put it in front of you and you have a choice, do you stab it into your heart or not?
Yes, correct.
Your refusal to stab it into your heart is proof that free will doesn't exist?
Yes, because every other decision you make is the exact same type of decision, different only in the degrees by which it varies. There are nuances. There are some that are harder decisions to make where one's only barely over than the other, and you decide for something as simple as a dog barked and distracted you during that crucial decision. But again, everything has a cause, and no matter how many times you run the simulation.
Yeah, we've established very well that computers are very good at predicting short-term things that we then rationalize what we made decisions for. But to me, that was not a revelatory thing because evolutionary, we're the more processing we need to do to make those short-term decisions, the less survival advantage it has. My question, my definition of free will is the idea that is this whole system from head to toenail, is this whole system capable of coming up with determining things that are not predictable to the outside universe?
And I would say I would say, because the problem that usually the answer that people come back with is like, well, how do you explain subatomic particles and the fact that they're truly random one side or another? That to me does not in any way change the argument, because all it means is, okay, now we're not making our decisions because of a set of preset initial conditions. Now we're doing it because at the subatomic level, there's a superposition between two different interactions. So that's still not free will as far as I'm concerned. I guess that's what the
we or the I is. I look at I as the whole system, not that there's, I'm going to find this magic little module in there and say, oh, you know, this is quantum influence on rhodopsin proteins. And this is where it comes. I'm like, no, like it's a somewhat chaotic system, but it's able to make, you know, interesting solutions, and it's like creating AI in a computer. You know, I mean, we're bio AI, you know, that there's this system that if you sit me in a room long enough and you ask me to come out with something original, I can create a pseudo random number, give it enough time that will be a pseudo essentially random of the universe. I can make determinations and things, give it enough time that this percolates inside. And that process in my head is the whole process. You know, we can keep looking, taking it apart, looking for where is free will. No, it's the whole thing. It's like the three body problem. You know, it's one of those desktop toys that has this sort of chaotic motion towards it. What's causing it? You know, well, I took apart this part of the pendulum, it wasn't there. I took this part of the pendulum, it wasn't there. I took this pendulum apart, it wasn't there. It doesn't exist. No, it's the whole thing.
Well, I think I grasp where you're coming from, but what concerns me is, if let's say in a bunch of different simulations, every time you run it, you know, there's one part in the story where Andrew goes into a room and spends 10 years trying to generate a random number. And then you come back and they're like, well, in 10 billion simulations, we got 10 billion random numbers. Like, I don't understand how it follows that therefore free will is real. Like, that doesn't sound to me like free will exists.
But I don't know what you define as free will. I would say that the problem is, I mean, it gets back to definitely. What do you define as free will? What does free will mean to you? To me,
and this is a very subjective thing. I like the fact that we're defining first terms here. Free will is the sensation of having a choice and choosing one that I want the most. And I believe that when I'm experiencing that subjective experience of choice, what I'm really doing is actuating a lifetime's worth of development combined with the current conditions under which I'm being asked to choose. And coming up with I feel like it's an illusion. That feeling like, oh, this is me choosing. I feel like no matter how many times you rewind the tape, either I'll pick the same one every time in a deterministic universe, or I will flip flop randomly in a, you know, if you take in the subatomic particle theory. But in either case, I don't feel like it's really because of me. There is no me. Me is the illusion created by the existence of all my bodily functions working at once.
Yeah, and I guess that for me, you know, like if – let's do this – we'll call it the Skittles dilemma, okay? Brian, I open up a fresh, delicious bag of Skittles and I wave it under your nose.
Mm-hmm.
Which one do you choose?
I feel like it'll either be it'd be an orange or a yellow one because the green ones are now sour apple and they suck.
I don't know why they did do this. That was their monsters.
They're monsters? What?
Whoever created the green that made the sour apple.
Yeah, can we talk about this? Apparently I'm in the minority on this, but this whole like the default green candy has to be sour apple. It can't be lime anymore is the worst thing that ever happened in my lifetime.
I agree with you. No, we're all in agreement.
We're not. Sour apple's great. See, you all suck it.
Okay. So right now, if I say it, so which one do you go for?
It'll either be yellow or orange because the other ones aren't really a choice based on my taste preferences. As I reach forward, there'll be other nuances. I might be affected because an orange one is more easy to grab, but I may notice that the orange one is a little bit reddish. And I know,
well, let's say that when they shut down the
orange and switch over to red, sometimes there's like a middle zone and it's
I'll
got more strawberry than
your
I want.
Mind, close your eye, rather close your eyes and sure. Just ask yourself that question in your head based upon just totally.
Okay, so you know, I'll say yellow right now. Right now, I feel like it's my free choice that I want to choose yellow.
Okay, now your eyes are closed. You're getting
you can either full hold choice. On, hold on. You can either throw that away or keep it.
No, hold on. Okay, your eyes are closed. You decided on yellow. If I give you a little bit more time, will that change?
It will, but only because my initial conditions will be altered. But internally,
I'm saying that if you're inside your head and you're like, I like lemon, and you're like, yeah, I'm going to go for that. But then if you're thinking, but I had lemon.
That's correct. You know, but the timing of your question also factors in. It's one of the initial conditions, right? Mm-hmm. Asking within the first 30 seconds, before I get in my head and cycle over to another thing. So I don't perceive that it's really, I perceive that it's my free choice, but I don't intellectually believe that it is. I guess what I'm saying is that
we can create situations where inside your head, without any external sensation, that you will change your mind, go back and forth, and there's a process. My belief, my definition is that system, which might be able to be mapped out on paper or whatever, or after the fact, that's what I define. That's a system. As far as I'm external to the world, to the universe, Brian made a free will choice. Brian made a choice there, and it could be random, it could be this or whatever, but there's going to be the part of the reason there is a rationalization implies that there was a logic to it, but it could be just the way everything bounces off of each other. But because it has these very interesting outcomes that are from the way the universe works are effectively non-deterministic, you know, once they get sufficiently complicated, once you have enough time in your head to think about it, that's good enough for me, you know?
Well, and then we get to the important part. Like, you know, of course, the argument tactics, usually at this point, people are like, so I guess that just means criminals should all go free, right? Because there's no free will. It's not my fault. My daddy abused me or whatever. It's like, no. At some level, you have to change perspectives, but at least, you know, functional models on there. And of course, all of this is to say, you know, I don't know and none of us know. But in terms of a simulation, I think most certainly we're experiencing a simulation every day because we don't actually experience the world we see, touch, or feel. Instead, our brain constructs a model based on a bunch of information, electrical impulses coming from our skin, from our olfactory senses, from our retinas, and it basically creates this illusion in which we live. So in that regard, it's 100% true that we are a simulation.
But not in the same. I mean, you're a discrete simulation different from my simulation, though.
That's, yes, correct. But, geez, this is heavy stuff. Justin, what say you? Where do you come down on all this?
I left the hot tub like 15 minutes ago.
You're already watching Super Troopers again?
I'm at it. I mean, come on, guys. Jesus, you know.
You started this, Justin.
Joking. I'm just making the joke. I'm more on the free will side of this particular argument. I think that there's while we can break down everything that we are probably more we are more informed, our actions are more informed than we believe they are. I don't think that means that proves the absence of any and all original decision making.
Phrase that again.
Like I see where like your point, as I can best understand it, is that we have so much that, like, even our understanding of an of a decision points us in the direction of a result, right?
Yes.
And while I think that is certainly true more than we would probably, if you were to ask people, how much are you led to make a decision based on the actions and evidence around you? People would probably underestimate that influence. I don't think that knowing that phenomenon happens invalidates the idea that we are making our own decisions.
Yeah, I guess. And again, it goes back to initial terms. Like, who is me? Me is the sum total of all my past experiences, my current body, my current financial situation, my kids, blah, 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 blah. You know, and it's like, insofar as what does that system want to choose in terms of favorite Skittles, then yes, if you bottle all of that up in there and call that Brian, then I guess Brian defined by that is making a choice, or Brian at that point is a algorithm that outputs a result. And in that moment, it quote unquote makes the choice, as I would restate it, you know, outputs the final variable or the answer of lemon at this moment.
Bryce just added a Skittles background to our video chat here.
Anytime we get into the question of whether free will is an illusion, this is our official backdrop brought to you by Skittles.
The Skittles choice.
Taste the rainbow.
Or do you?
So there you have it. Brian says, we're all mindless robots. Kill if you want. It's totally cool. Totally fine, because... Does that sum it up exactly, pretty much, Brian?
Yeah, sure.
Eat poo. We're all robots, unfeeling. Yeah.
He's the only one with a hot tub, though. So.
it's almost like these are questions people have been asking for a long time and will be asking for a long time into the future.
Well, so back to Elon Musk specifically, like, how does it make you feel that largely it looks like this is sort of being pigeonholed as a, oh, did you hear what old Wacky Musk is saying again? He thinks blur to blur.
Well, you know, it's if you watch the whole conversation he had at Recode, which is, it's fascinating because it's Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher, and you watch, you watch two of the leading tech journalists in the world being befuddled and confused and trying hard and failing to keep up with, you know, one of the most, you know, brilliant minds of our age. and it's shocking to hear what's new to them. But anyhow, yeah, I mean, I've seen some snide sort of commentary. Oh, he thinks we're living inside of that. And Elon Musk is like, well, if you accept this and you accept this, tell me where the argument goes off base. You know, which part do you have a problem with? And that's true. It's like if you accept, and you can say, well, I don't accept that first point. Like, okay, you know, where computers are going to stop evolving. You know, his point was if computers, he starts off a video game, you look at a Pong, you look at how Pong got, and you look at how detailed a video game is now. And if you say that even if it takes 10,000 years, eventually they're going to be as realistic as the world in which we live in. And if the inhabitants of that world think that they're in a very real world and you can build, you know, a billion worlds just like that, then chances are, if you are a person experiencing what you think is the real world, you're probably not, right? And he's like, at what point does that go off the rails? What problem do you have? A problem? And you could say, well, I don't think computers are going to get any more involved than the ones we have right now, which is kind of a hard one to say.
It's a rough
you could be
bet.
Like, yeah. I don't. What's that?
That's a rough bet.
Yeah, and you could say like, well, I don't think you could have somebody who digitally thinks that they are actually real. And well, that was our just discussion is that, you know, Brian made the case that, you know, we may be even less complicated than we think we are. If you break us down into algorithms and stuff, that our concepts of free will and all this are so deterministic at a certain level that it's hard to even draw a circle and say this is free will. So, you know, if you think that we have a more complex version of free will, well, guess what? You could probably convince yourself of that illusion too. So,
boy, this was all just from almost a kind of technological perspective that we've discussed it so far. When you start reading about the neuroscience of stuff, when personalities change because someone got a railroad spike through, you know, the one part of their brain that controls a certain aspect of their personality, like, you know, it's like you're telling me that he has free will when, and you know, there's cases where people were demonstrably not the slightest bit attracted to child pornography until they had a brain operation and it cut out the wrong part of the brain, and then suddenly they had an insatiable urge, you know, for and became oversexed. I mean, it's real tough to convince me that free will is something that we could just muscle through or something,
but,
you know.
But I mean, that gets into, you know, I can't use my free will to convince myself that I'm not hungry. You know, I can't when my tummy's getting rumbling and tells me I'm hungry. My free will doesn't mean I'm disconnected from physical urges and those sorts of things. And the reason that we say that people are accountable legally in courts of law is that, yes, you have these urges, but then you have a certain amount of accountability to say, hey, I can't control this, or I have a trouble, you know, trouble there. And free will doesn't imply that you have magical physical control over every aspect of your body or of your brain. And absolutely, the brain studies show frighteningly how if you damage one area – how you don't have the kind of controls over certain things that you do. I think that our free will is much more in sort of a narrower kind of, you know, a deterministic, what will I do tomorrow kind of way, and figuring that out. But I won't be able to say, and tomorrow I will not be hungry at all. Ain't going to happen.
Right. There's a one more thought, and I know we could go on this, you know, for 10,000 years as philosophers have.
By the way, for those of you who are only listening, just understand that now Bryce is there is a flash of Skittles with every camera cut. It just everything gets faded to Skittle and then back up to different cameras.
This will be a good way to segue into picks, because my pick is going to be CGP Grey is a YouTube channel that recently put out a video called YOUARETWO, and it talks about the difference between the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, and about how for most of us the two are always connected through the corpus callosum, and left hemisphere looks through the left the right eye, the right hemisphere controls the left side, and so on. By and large, you know, it's easy to say, well, it's like you, this is you, a single unit in there. But there are people who have had the corpus callosum cut in half in order to prevent epileptic seizures. I don't think that's very popular nowadays, but in the 70s it was. And they figured out that the two brains kind of don't agree. Kind of argue with each other quite a bit, and they would do things like you would pick up an object with the left hand that you only see with your right eye, and then they'd say, "Well, why did you do that?" And because the language center of your brain is only on the right side, I'm getting all of this mixed up and totally wrong. But because the language center is on the other side, you would make up an excuse. You're like, I always wanted to learn how to, you know, grab a Rubik's Cube. It's a fascinating video, fascinating brain stuff, and CGP Grey is a good channel.
Yeah, it's a great example of showing how these experiments, when we're asked sort of these sort of shorter term things or these tasks, and how we develop these sort of ego satisfying rationalizations to why we did it, because so much of what we do, you know, is muscle memory, short term, quick, come up with something. And when I think of free will and all that, I think kind of longer term creativity, you know, longer plan out. But I absolutely think that, yeah, the evidence is very, very strong that so many of the decisions we think we made of a free mind are programmed in there, and we just tell ourselves a wonderful story afterwards why we did it, which isn't true.
Yeah.
Man, yeah. I hemmed and hawed on this forever, right? I was like, man, do I get it? Do I not?
Can you reenact it for us? Him. Oh.
Hands on my hips. Do I do this? I'm like sitting on a country porch in front of like a general store, you know.
Playing the banjo.
There's a barrel, you know, some guys playing checkers and all that. I'm looking at the fading sun and all that. You know, maybe a Model T rolls down the road. And I've got like a little piece of straw hanging out of my mouth. Pipe tobacco's in the air. There's a little Franklin stove in there, you know, heating up the place. What's going on, Andrew? My guys, I reckon I'm in a fix here. I'm trying to decide what I should do.
Oh, heck. Me and old JRY.
They're like, it's weird because although you were born in Opelika, Alabama, your accent sucks. You all don't know what it's like to move from Alabama to Oregon to Florida and California. Point is Apple's got themselves an iPad Pro. Now, I reckon I could sure use one of them dar things.
Well, so you're now, I think it's fair to share. I don't think we're outing you as in general, you're a fan of the stuff that Apple produces. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan, but like, I mean, I will go on and on about how much I like my Amazon Echo over Siri. You know, I would say I'm an Apple fanboy to a degree, but I'm also like, when the Kool-Aid's sweeter somewhere else, I'll go drink that sweet, sweet Kool-Aid.
Well, or so. Also when that Kool-Aid is $999 for a base edition of.
Oh yeah, you know, and it's like, and I love my iPad Air. Like, well, this Air is plenty good, so. I was on the fence, but the reason I wanted to get the iPad Pro was I was tempted with it was the fact that as a writer, as a guy who writes words, when I sit down to edit, one of the things I like to do is I like to print things out into full papers, full page, take my red pen and go through them one by one, and kind of it has been demonstrated that we process information differently if we're typing notes or if we're writing things down. People who journal, it is there's tons of evidence that shows that electronic forms of information recall and usage are very different on how you do it. And I know personally, if I have a printed page in front of me or page size thing and I have something in my hand to make notes with, it's different than looking at a screen and using a keyboard. So I had a reason to do the iPad Pro. I had a justification for it, but man, I was like, I was on the fence with that. And I just finished, don't tell my editor, but I actually finished a while ago, like her first round of edits and making, going them through there. But I begged for more time and told her that I'm not done yet. Cause I want more time on the book. So I pleaded incompetence. What I wanted to do was take the book, the latest Jessica Blackwood book, and then go. I already went through the whole thing. I wanted to go through it again, but this time do more red line notes, do my own notes, and do that. And so I said, you know what? Just do it. Like, go ahead. Like, you know, there's like, you know, exchange policies are pretty good for tech gadgets. You can take something home for a couple weeks if it works, fine. If not, you can bring it back. So I went down. I broke down and I got myself the 12 and a half inch whatever iPad Pro. One, this thing is giant. This is about the size of my first large flat screen TV.
Yeah.
it's huge. I mean, it is for viewing things. It is absolutely gorgeous. When I pull up one of my, what I loved about it was I could put Microsoft Word on here, right? And then I could take a document and then I have one of like, here's the first page of my book, right? So I can take the first page of my book. And for our audio listeners, this is great. Is you see the whole page. I'm looking at the whole page, right? And Microsoft Word has this wonderful function where if you use the pencil or if you have a Microsoft Surface, same thing. Although I've been playing around with my friend's Surface. I like this better. Is I can draw circles. I can draw stuff around and make red notes, or I can highlight things if I want to. I can choose a highlighter and choose the thickness of this. And boom, it's highlighted. So it makes it really, really easy if I want to copy edit my manuscript, right? So I can sit it down in there, edit it in a full screen, large environment. That's the principal reason that I got it. Then I said, you know what? Since I'm doing the interest-free financing, it's not like credit's real money, guys. Totally doesn't count. Totally doesn't count.
Nope.
I got the keyboard, the Apple keyboard. I weighed that against getting the Logitech one, which has got backlit, which is cool. This is super thin. That's the keyboard case cover. See that, yep. Audio listeners?
Yeah, no, it's very thin. I want you to imagine something really, really thin. That's what it looks like.
Plugs right in, boom, and it pops out. And I like this keyboard a lot. This keyboard's one of my favorite compact keyboards I've ever played with. So, you know, you sit that next to yourself, like it's almost like a real computer.
Well, and that's my question is, what niche does it fill? We talked about this a little bit before the show. For me, I got a recent generation iPad that I liked a lot, and then I got the Plus, and then I just realized even I would take the iPad with me on every freaking trip, and I would just never pull it out because the Plus always had enough battery and just enough bigger screen. Now, obviously, for what I'm using it for is different from, you know, you're writing books on this thing. Do you feel like you're able to have it replace your laptop for most use?
Yeah, there's not a single case that the only problem that I've run into is, you know, some websites, you know, that are like, I was trying to do like Code School or one of the Code Academy or one of those things on it, and it just didn't want to work on an iPad, but they have apps for that. But you know, you do get into that, the limitations that some of your web stuff has become so much more, you know, sophisticated. But I would say that it has not really been a problem, not at all. I've had everything I do is either Word, almost the only software I use that's not on the iPad but is supposed to be coming is Scrivener for everything else. And I find, let me ask you this, guys, do you find yourself sometimes going to your iPads or your iPhones to do certain tasks because it's easier than using your computer?
Yeah. Yeah, especially for any kind of screen grabby thing. Like if I want to, if I see something, even if I'm on my desktop computer and I see something, I won't want to necessarily pull out, you know, open up Snip. You have to save it as a file. You have to upload it, then send it over here. You know, little things like posting to Instagram or whatever. You see something quirky, it just gets easier to do it straight from the phone to begin with.
Yeah, there are a lot of, so like I find that the idea of what's happened with mobile and phones is the idea of creating these single purpose apps or apps that sort of do one thing really well has been extremely useful. So anyhow, with Dropbox, everything I keep on Dropbox, you know, the whole world is synced. So I'm only, you know, only like 48 hours in on this. You know, next week I'll let you know how it is a week later working at this. But I'm like, oh, I need to work. Oh, it was so much easier just to sit down with the document and the pencil and make some edits and fix it that I'm excited. So, Justin?
Number one, as soon as Andrew got one, I just knew that, like, this is just going to be this. Maybe, you know what? I'm flipping my opinion now about free will. I don't think it exists now. Now that Andrew got an iPad Pro, man, like, that's all I want is, like, now I'm just looking around at my studio setup here, and I'm like, I could get a stand, and it could be, like, just a permanent soundboard, and oh, it would, dude, just, like, all the buttons would be so gigantic. It'd be
impossible to miss. Here.
Yeah, look, and Andrew's just doing it. All right, now he's just being, yeah, so I'm, my pick next week is my brand new iPad Pro. this week, I'm going to recommend, all right, so we talk, I don't know if we've talked about this. I talked with Andrew about it on Hotline Monday. I love the Lonely Island. I've loved their YouTube videos, and I think they're great. They put out a new movie called Pop Star, Never Stop Stopping, this weekend. It is kind of a mockumentary of the modern music scene through the lens of a kind of Justin Bieber esque character that is played by Andy Samberg. The movie is good, but what I stupidly kind of didn't realize until after the movie was over is that this is effectively a brand new Lonely Island album, because he has all these songs and they have these songs in the movie and the songs are great. So my pick is the Pop Star Never Stop Stopping soundtrack, which is to me, super fun. I did enjoy the movie. I liked it. There were frustrating elements of it that I think is more because of the potential of the movie than it is necessarily errors in the movie. But I love the soundtrack. I thought it was really, really funny. And there's a lot of, especially in the kind of satire. They have a very Macklemore inspired satire called Equal Rights, wherein he is rapping about how everybody should have the right to marry each other while reminding everybody every other line that he's straight. There's a very, I thought probably one of the highlights of the movie was they have a Tyler, the Creator parody called Hunter the Hungry. And the two songs that they have on that on the soundtrack and in the movie are, like, really good. They're good. The Lonely Island makes good movies or music and movies, ? But if you like The Lonely Island, you will very much like the soundtrack.
Gentlemen, headline Drudge Report right now. They're all furiously typing away.
Wait for it.
Oh, wow. Wow. Fed set to approve private moon mission.
Wow.
So apparently the Moon Express, which is described as a obscure space exploration company, after months of lobbying by Moon Express officials and high-level deliberations among federal agencies led by the White House Science Office, the people familiar with the matter said, this is the Wall Street Journal, the company appears close to paying what is called mission approval. So basically, that, you know, if you wanted to have, you needed to have, like, the FAA and everybody else sort of approve on that. So it looks like they're going to send a 22-pound payload. It's the company's lander slated to be blasted into orbit from a New Zealand site by the 52-foot Electron rocket manufactured by Rocket Lab. Remember them with the video?
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know what the time frame is here, but hokey shokes. It's very interesting, folks.
It would have to be approved. The formal launch license would get approval in the second half of 2017. Wait, approval for the formal launch license for the second half of 2017. So I guess they would want to do it in the second half of 2017.
Yep.
Right on.
So think about this. This is the roadmap right now is next year. We look like plans are first private mission to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Year after that, 2018.
MARS.
SpaceX, yes. SpaceX wants to send a Dragon capsule to the Mars in 2018, okay? Folks, that's well within the Marvel Phase 2 timeline. Okay. Now, we're not going to name names here. We're not going to name names. I may have spoken to somebody at SpaceX today and said, what's your thought on that 2018 time frame? And this person, he or she,
who knows?
Zer.
We can't even verify whether or not this person said it of their own free will, because we don't even know that that exists.
Yeah, he, she, Zer, whatever you want to say, said, well, by the way they've been having us work, it certainly seems like they're going towards that, you know, full steam ahead as if they plan to. SpaceX is very serious about a 2018 Mars mission. So we've got Moon Express next year. And Elon Musk at the Recode conference had mentioned that he wanted to launch his human mission in 2024.
That would be fantastic. And in the literal sense of the word, the classical sense, it would be fantastic.
Well, it's just too bad we stopped dreaming. Hashtag still not over it. Hashtag people don't forget.
It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.